You're listening to a Countout Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Ballad, a place the conversation begins. I'm your host, Ryan Nancy. Today, we have sort of a quick turnaround, I guess you could say, for this episode, mostly because, look, this we're going to be discussing someone that Dave just put out. The ballad is officially out. Dave typically puts out at the end of the last, you know, when he announces who's in the Hall of Fame and everything last year, he announces some of the new nominees. And that's kind of what we did all season, was talk about those new nominees. And I said all season as well that usually if someone passes away, sadly, Dave will throw on someone onto the ballot for the first time ever. And we have two that are those first time evers. But today we're only discussing one of them, that is a Canadian, or rather a Texan legend in Canada, the one and only Mr. Irresistible, Sweet Daddy Siki. So to discuss Sweet Daddy Siki, there was really, I'll be honest, one person to turn to. This person has written about Sweet Daddy Siki an immense amount of time. He wrote about him in, I have it on my iPad, I believe it was the Heroes and Icon book. I got the thumbs up. And he not only has written about him in several times in various books, he has also been a good long friend with Sweet Daddy Siki, earned that trust to help write and sort of put together a 2017 documentary, obviously titled Sweet Daddy Siki, all about the man himself. So joining me today is Greg Oliver. Greg, thank you very much for coming on to the ballot.
There, you get the thumbs up for me. Yeah, no, Sweet Daddy Siki was truly one of a kind. And one of my very special memories of him was delivering him his copy of Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame Heroes and Icons, which I wrote with Steve Johnson and Mike Mooneyham. And he wanted to meet at the McDonald's near his house. And so we met there, and I brought my son, who was probably, he was about 8 at the time. Mm-hmm. And just Siki would always rave about my son every time after that. I know we're getting off topic already, but get used to that.
No, I love it.
Siki was a really personable guy. He really liked people.
Yeah, I believe
he didn't trust her easily. So
we'll certainly talk about that, because I'll play a lot when it comes to the documentary. That's how people say those words. I very much appreciate you coming on. Like I said, I think that sadly, you know, doing a lot of research for the show, as I try to do, and obviously this was a little bit shorter time span for me. You know, I don't have like a year long to do a bunch of research. But like looking for research regarding Sweet Daddy Siki is like somewhat difficult, because it doesn't really feel like there was a lot written about him, at least I could find. And what I could find was pretty much exclusively written by you. And that is something that happens before. I mean, we had that with Gilbert Leduc for Rest of the World region when we had Phil Lyons on, because he pretty much does exclusively extremely historical French catch wrestling history study. So it is sort of those things of, he is somebody that is, you're basically, what I'm trying to say here, Greg, is you're somebody that's keeping the Sweet Daddy Siki torch alive. And that is something I very much appreciate. I'm sure that's something he appreciated. And I'm very happy that you're on to discuss him today, because I don't think there's a better expert out there than you.
Thank you. No, he was a special guy and deserving of the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. I guess we're going to talk about that.
Of course. So first off, what I always ask everybody, this might be a loaded question specifically for you, but what I first ask every single guest on the show is, what is your connection to Sweet Daddy Siki? And again, a loaded question, I'm sure.
Yeah, where to start? So I first saw him when he was still wrestling and training. Like, I never really saw him wrestle very much, but he was a trainer, I guess, the first time I met him. And I didn't really get to know him until years later when, we started the Slam Wrestling website at part of Canoe and the Sun Media website. And at some point, I'd reached out to him to talk to him. And he recognized that I knew something about this newfangled internet thing. And at that point, he started bugging me because he didn't want his name associated with Ron Hutchison anymore.
Yes.
Because they ran a school together. And it's like, can you take my name off there? And I had to try to explain to him how the internet worked. And it's, no, it's very much out of my control. So from that point, though, he would call me about questions about pro wrestling, about people that he knew and whatever happened to. And that was sort of the genesis of of our relationship. Certainly when I started going to Cauliflower Alley clubs, there'd be times I'd come home with a phone number for him or say, you know, Bill Olivius really wants to talk to you. Or, man, I was just talking to Cowboy Bob Ellis. He really wants to talk to you again. And I pass on these numbers. So, again, you build trust. And that'll come up again later. But so Siki became this old guy that would call me out of the blue sometimes and just to talk a little bit about the current wrestling scene and wonder what happened to some old friends. Wasn't all the time. And we didn't really get to know each other till the documentary. And then we got to know each other really well, driving up and down the roads in the car and stuff.
Yeah, of course, you help write and sort of put together, you know, I would say almost a silent secret producer in terms of credits of the Sweet Daddy Siki documentary that came out in 2017. I want to talk a little bit about that because that's a big aspect, obviously, about him, because that is, you know, as long as I can read, I guess I'll say that much, because as far as I could tell, I couldn't find it anywhere on the internet. I know we've corresponded about this before. I've looked high and low, but I'm sure people have seen it out there. But I want to talk about a little bit of the documentary and how that came together. You mentioned a lot about building that trust with him. What was that jumping off point into, hey, you know, hey, do you want to do this thing? Do you want to tell your life story this way? You know, what was that conversation like with him?
Well, we built a trust. Like, he would come out to, we ran six Titans in Toronto dinners, which were like celebratory dinners for, you know, Toronto area wrestlers. And he came out to a couple of them. Often there were conflicts with his karaoke, because he ran a karaoke in Toronto's East End. And so that was like his gig.
Yes.
So he didn't want to give up a Saturday night, but if we could have him out early on the Saturday afternoon, at a wrestling show, he came out, and then he came out another time for like cocktail hour, and then went down to do karaoke. So that was sort of the beginning of it all. And through that process, I worked with the Megan boys, who are the guys who put together the Iron Sheik documentary, just called mm-hmm. The Sheik. And they're the nephews, not exactly nephews, of course, but they that's what they call themselves, of the Sheik. And so they're the ones that put together that documentary. And that got their feet in the door, and they got a little bit of a bug about wanting to do more of the documentaries just in general. And so Siki came up a couple of times. They kept bugging me. And finally, I asked Siki, and that led to a dinner, a buffet dinner, and where we pitched the idea. And he basically said, as long as I was involved, he would trust the process, which is quite flattering to me, obviously, because I'd never really been too involved in film. I had done a little bit of, you know, appearances here and there on TV shows and things, but never actually been involved in a film. So it was really great to learn from the producer, Jeremy Schell, and the director, Harv Glazer, just to be able to sit with them. I was in almost every interview he did in the film, and it's still out there, but it's hard to get access to, and we've been sort of trying to bug the actual owners of the film that have the rights to it to put it out there available for fans again. So hopefully when Siki's in this Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, that's a good reason to re-release it. Is that the news hook we need to get it out there again?
A 4K redux for the Hall of Famer.
I don't know. But it was a fun process just to be a part of, because, you know, we had the actual launch up here in a Toronto theater, and then Keith Elliott Greenberg and I went across the street and started drinking and went back to our house and kept drinking, and they missed his flight because we'd had a little bit too much Jack Daniels and you know, things like that. But I mean, that's a small element of it. It's everything we did along the way that, you know, whether it's sitting with Siki in the car and asking him things that never ended up in the movie, or sitting there asking him about 1,000 questions, or writing up questions to ask Edge because I couldn't make that interview, or George Cavallo, the boxer. But the ultimate part of the movie, which I wish he could have seen, was him singing with Charley Pride.
Yeah, and I saw you write up about that, I believe.
African American characters, you know, sitting down together. And the funny thing is, there was actually a first director that worked on it, and he didn't really think it was that big a deal. But the producer insisted that they shoot them together, and we got a magical moment when they're singing together. And Siki had a really blown up picture of him and his son and Charlie Pride that he had in his house that he just, you know, he treasured. He treasured that moment. That doesn't mean he didn't meet a lot of celebrities on the way, because he'd met Etta James, he'd met Muhammad Ali, all these things, because we're jumping around a lot here, as I say I do.
You're good.
The Black culture of the time, there were only so many places these guys could stay on the road.
Yeah.
So if he's on the road in Florida, chances are there's going to be other performers, band leaders or you know, guitarists or whatever, may not be the stars, but all these guys are in the same hotel. And so you'd get to know the other Black performers out there in Southern US especially. So Siki had lots of those kind of stories, some of which ended up in the book, or sorry, not in the book, in the movie. Others just were things, stories he told us about. He was a very guarded guy, didn't always want to tell all the dark secrets of his life and pro wrestling, even just the idea of kayfabe, right? And telling that wrestling was worked. Took a long time, and he was a lot like Bruno Sammartino that way, which is another way I earned his trust. But just in the idea that Bruno, he knew that he could talk about the business openly, but never went out of his way to do so. And that was what Siki was like too. He knew it was okay to talk about the business, but he didn't really want to get into, you know, this promoter screwed me, or this happened here, or, you know, I was part of Buddy Rogers' posse, and, you know, I knew I was safe with him, with promoters, all those kind of things. Siki would talk about it a little bit, but you'd have to sort of prod him to get a little bit more.
I imagine, especially at the beginning of the documentary, there was a little bit of that tough, like, telling the truth of in kayfabe and getting it out of him. And then I hope to imagine that as the documentary went along, he was able to be a little more open about stuff.
Yeah, and there was also the case too, like, you'd bring in a couple other people to talk about him, and he recognized that the documentary was about more than just the deep underbelly of pro wrestling, right? We had people talking about race and how Toronto was a particularly more open city, which is he settled here because he married a white woman. So whereas, you know, he didn't have that possibilities down in the Southern US, and there are other Black athletes, whether they were from the Toronto Argos Canadian Football League team, or whether they were Bernice Carnegie is heavily involved with the Herb Carnegie. He was one of the first you know, successful high-end Black hockey players. So he always fought racism, never played in the NHL. But that kind of idea that he was always fighting for those opportunities. And CK may not have been at the forefront out there waving the placards and going to government stuff, but in his own way, he broke down barriers for sure and became a very colorful part of the Toronto landscape.
Yeah, I think that's obviously so important. I think that's a good segue to talking about a little bit of his history. Obviously, you know, born in Texas, but, you know, and learn how to wrestle and had some difficulties, you know, getting a license just because of the South and who he was and all these sort of things, but eventually was able to start wrestling back in the early 60s, I believe, is when he started, maybe late 50s, but early 60s. And then eventually moved up to Toronto and basically stayed there ever since, up until his death late last year. You know, singing his hearts out, like you said, every week at in the karaoke bars and whatnot. He obviously wrestled in other places. I believe he had a stint in the WWWF up in New York. He worked not Mid-South, was it? I think it was just Memphis, perhaps, in the 80s.
Yep, yeah, that was his last big run, was Memphis with Lawler, yeah.
Yeah, so he obviously, you know, worked everywhere else in the States at large, but obviously found his home foundation in Toronto. Did he ever talk about, you know, what was his attraction to Toronto? Was it just sort of that, like, sort of racially safety net that an open city like Toronto had, or was there something else just about the city that he fell in love with?
A little bit of everything. So his wife, Anne, who is Estonian, she had connections to Toronto. So she was an immigrant here as well. Mm-hmm. They actually got married, if I remember correctly, in Buffalo. You know, it just became home to them, right? Like they needed a place to settle, to be able to travel. He'd basically been blackballed from wrestling in the U.S. He tells a story in the documentary, and he's told it fairly often, is, you know, he took his wife, who was white, to a function run by Vince McMahon Sr. And, you know, the whispers started, you know, you can't have a black man dating a white woman around here. Nobody said it overtly, right? It was just sort of, and it's hard for us as, you know, Caucasian people to understand how sure. that sort of happens, right? It's very subtle. Slowly the bookings dry up, all those kind of things. You're not getting the money you used to. And he quickly realized that, you know, his days were numbered here in the WWF. And he made a decision. He ended up in Toronto where Frank Tunney was a much more open promoter. Mm-hmm. He was happy to use him. It was a great base for him to travel across Canada. You know, Siki was a star in, you know, well, Vancouver and in Stampede Wrestling and then out east in the Maritimes. He was a legend. So, you know, he had all these different places, and Montreal too. So he had all these places to work just based out of Toronto, and getting on Toronto TV gave him a chance to really get out there and become an iconic figure, certainly in Canada.
A lot of his history in terms of wrestling, I think, begins really with Buddy Rogers, right? He becomes a friend of Buddy Rogers and starts working with him a lot.
His success starts there. But I mean, he came home from the Korean War.
Yep.
Where he served the U.S., but he didn't actually see any action. He was actually on the boat as the armistice was signed. Mm-hmm. So he was there, and he ended up spending about a year in Korea, I think he said, you know, just helping keep the peace. And so it wasn't, you know, active duty in that sense. There wasn't any war going on, but he certainly served. And he came home, and so that meant later that he was able to be a part of the Canadian Legion, and hang out with other people who served. That was an aspect of him that doesn't get talked about a lot.
I was looking through, sorry to interrupt, but I was looking through newspaper, newspaper.com, I think is just what it is, and looking up just at archives of the Toronto Star. And I think there was, if I recall correctly, I didn't save it, but
there was an article, absolutely, about, yeah, he was initially banned from the Legion because he wasn't, you know, Canadian served or whatever. And they're a lot looser now about who's in the Legion than they were then. But you're right. You're remembering that correctly. That was a Toronto Star story. And again, it was partly because of Sweet Daddy Siki. I mean, he kept the blonde hair his entire life. Mm-hmm. So he always stood out. People always remembered him. Why wouldn't you want a guy like this coming into the Legion? And perhaps he might bring his karaoke equipment. I don't know.
A sweet bonus that we might get is we might have some fun karaoke nights with Sweet Daddy Siki.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure, yeah, fun. And he loved doing that. He loved entertaining. I got to do karaoke with him a couple of times, mm-hmm. Including once there were some Japanese super fans that came by my house. You know, we had a meal and just chilled, and then we went down to see Sweet Daddy Siki in like January weather or whatever it was. It was crazy cold up here in Toronto, and the one guy actually kept my wife's letter jacket from university, and we never got it back. So it's just funny little stories that come up, and I hadn't thought about that till we started talking.
Well, hopefully, I guess, or I was gonna say hopefully you track that down, but I have to imagine that's lost in the wind at this point.
Yeah, Shuhei had it, and Shuhei Aoki has since passed on, so yes, unfortunately that's the reality. But the fact that I spent a couple of great trips with Shuhei. He was a great friend. And again, he's just one more guy I associate with Sweet Daddy Siki in some ways. But he and I did one road trip another time to go find Goldie Rogers and then Phil Watson, who was Whipper Watson's son. So, mm-hmm. you know, like there's all these adventures that come along when you actually leave the house and hit the road, right?
Well, Greg, sadly, I'm a wrestling podcaster, so I don't go outside that often. So anyways, there was two little pivot points that I'm not exactly sure which road to take. So obviously, we want to talk about his career. We started off, you know, that's where the success really begins with Buddy Rogers. But the hair is also such an important aspect that we should discuss.
We probably got to jump back. So he actually went to Sandor Zabel's gym.
Yes.
Right? In the early days, he didn't actually learn. He learned from Ray Ortega, not Sandra Szabo, who he basically only ever met in brief. So that's L.A. in the mid-50s. Mm-hmm. And he tried boxing, this and that, and had some trouble. You know, you've seen a couple of the articles where his real name actually comes up. And
yes.
That he was very protective of for many, many years. But as Elkin James, he couldn't get the permit he wanted to be a wrestler. And so, but boxing he got, it's all sort of convoluted and strange, but he ends up being a pro wrestler down in Arizona, very small town, small time territory. And he learned the ropes there with Bill Olivas and a very young Cowboy Bob Ellis and some of those guys that he would often talk about those days, you know, when you're really doing the baloney blowouts where you're getting basically no money and surviving as best you can, are end up being really special. Just like, you know, maybe your days in junior hockey, your days in the AAA baseball, like you may not have made the big money, but you made some lifelong friendships and the memories that go with that mm-hmm. stick with you forever. But yeah, then he eventually meets Buddy Rogers and becomes part of the Buddy Rogers touring group where yeah. Buddy surrounded himself with guys he could trust. And that says a lot about Siki right there. And that if Buddy Rogers, you know, who was the biggest star of the late 50s, 1960s, if he trusted you, you're all right.
Which I believe, if not mistaken, NWA World Heavyweight Champion at the time as well.
Or he was for a part portions. Of that time. Yes, absolutely. And then he becomes the first, you know, WWF champion. Mm-hmm. And doesn't hold it very long. And then Bruno wins that. But the Bruno story is when Bruno was coming up to Toronto for a wrestler reunion, I was talking to him ahead of time. I did a story for Slam Wrestling about, you know, all Bruno's Toronto connections, right? He does not become Bruno Sammartino superstar without his time in Toronto,
yep.
where Frank Tunney gave him a chance to really be the top dog. And then he goes back to New York, where he essentially been blackballed the same way as in a different sense than Siki was, but you know, he yeah. wasn't being used and he left there. But when I talked to Bruno, he goes, I want you to make sure that Willie the Wolfman Farkas comes out to see me when I'm here and Sweet Daddy Siki. And so I made sure both those guys came out to see Bruno, and I felt an honor that, you know, he's giving me orders to do that. And Siki, again, he came out on the Thursday night, not on the weekend because he was doing karaoke, but he came out to see Bruno. And then Wolfman was around all weekend. I mean, he just loved seeing his old friends again, whether it was Dominic DiNucci or mm-hmm. Bruno or whomever it was. Willie the Wolfman was another special character.
There's a theme I'm picking up here that I'm really enjoying, and I'm just going to pinpoint real quick how much not only people love Sweet Daddy Siki, you know, you're talking about Bruno, talking about Buddy Rogers, but trust, and obviously trust is a big word when it comes to professional wrestling, especially when you're in the ring and throwing yourself around and striking all that jazz. But like trust is a big thing. Having that with Buddy Rogers, having that with Bruno, having that with you. With Sweet Daddy Siki, that just seems like a great theme of people seem to really enjoy working with him a lot. And so much so that they, you know, deeply, you know, wanted to become friends with him and had this sort of lifelong friendship.
Yeah, I think he had that aspect of him professionally, but then the flip side is that you heard about how cheap he was.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't a big spender.
Yeah,
I talked to musicians that we never used, went down the road very much because he actually had a touring band, Sweet Daddy Siki and the Irresistibles.
Yep.
So I talked to a couple of guys who played with him in the research for the documentary. We didn't really ever end up using any of it in the documentary. But, you know, again, he was a hard taskmaster as far as being the boss of the road. But, you know, he was a great musician. So they enjoyed performing, at least, even if he was a bit of a hard ass as a boss. So, yeah, I mean, you can respect somebody, enjoy spending time with them and still have some disagreements, right? That's
of course,
what
of course.
Being a grown-up's about. You can, you know, have one point here, disagree with it and still respect the other person. Seems yeah. to be lost a little bit these days. I don't know if you've noticed that. So
I That's a whole tangent. a whole tangent. That's a whole another hour of recording that we'll talk about and then cut out here. So I like that. And I if I recall correctly, in the trailer there was that sort of theming as well of people showing a lot of love as well. Obviously, for the documentary, you all these wrestlers are going to show a lot of love, from Bret Hart, Adam Copeland. You know, the list goes on and on. Of all these people really respecting and loving the guy and having a lot of trust in him. And, you know, obviously I think, you know, you spoke about how, you know, a little bit later in life there is I don't get the vibe that it's like a disdain towards wrestling or anything per se, but just sort of like keeping everything at a distance and just sort of like, I'm going to do my thing of karaoke. And people wanting to reach out to him. So that sort of thing of like that respect and love that people had for him, it lasted forever. Even if he was having a little guardrails put up, people still wanted to break that down, tear that down. And obviously, you know, to a certain degree, Greg, you helped tear those walls down a little bit to help bring more of that love back to Sweet Daddy Siki.
I did, but, you know, we never got him down to, a convention, right? To go down to one of the big New York conventions. You know, they wanted him to. He just wasn't interested. So, I mean,
well, it's gonna
he didn't mind doing local time. Things. Well, yeah, he would have missed karaoke in the weekend, and that was important to him. Like, it's hard to describe. And the Duke Tavern, where he used to perform, where I went down a couple of times, it's not exactly, you know, the Taj Mahal. It's a bit rough kind of place, and then a few stories of fights and stuff that happened there. But I mean, he just loved it, and you know, they celebrated him. The documentary has sort of like a birthday party for him, where they made him a cake at the Duke. It's just who he was, right? He was just so memorable as a person, and he still had that slow sort of Texas drawl a little bit when he talked, and he's one of those personalities I'll never forget. And I hope wrestling fans are buying into this in the sense that he was a much bigger star than I think a lot of people recognize. He was the top star or one of the top guys, wherever he was wrestling. It's just, we tend to prioritize success based on the big territories, which is very unfair. Because being on top, let's say in Stampede or Memphis or, you know, Arizona, right? Wherever you may be, you can be the top dog and make a lot of money in a smaller territory and be happy. Mm-hmm. And so you never got that big run in the AWA or the NWA. It's like, and it didn't really matter at the time, right? It was more about what you did for your life. The thing about Siki is he didn't have his kids with Anne till they were settled in Toronto too. So he was one of those guys that was around for his kids. And if you talk to any wrestlers, that's a rarity, right? They, they often were on the road, weren't there for raising the kids, all that kind of stuff. So instead he's the guy going down to his kid's school and, you know, all the parents are freaking out. It's Sweet Daddy Siki, or he's driving around in his purple hearse. yes. So, you know, he was a well-known dude.
Yeah, purple hearse, bleach blonde hair, which obviously was his signifier, his classic, his gimmick, I guess you could say.
It wasn't real. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. that he had basically, you know, I don't know when I forget what year it was in the book, but very early in his career, I believe, because he did a while of the wrestler BS talk. I was going to say his shoot hair color before in a while. And then eventually switched to the bleach blonde look
I think when he's on the early Dumont Network shows, he's got, you know, the great physique. And that was another thing we haven't really talked about is his physique, but he had the dark hair and he'd done a couple of rock and roll songs. And most people associate him with country music, right? Cause he really loved country. And that's certainly what the you know, Sweet Daddy Siki and the Irresistibles and his albums are, but he did some rock and roll songs back then. So of course the Dumont Network was a national network, like we think of with ABC or CBS now. It was a huge deal. Wrestling was an easy thing for those early stations to broadcast, right? It was a one or two camera shot. And there's some great footage we got, because a lot of that Dumont wrestling footage exists, and it's owned by a company in Chicago. So we have some great old footage of that. And then eventually he just, you know, sees the Etta James kind of idea and decides to do that when he's in New York. And that changes everything for him. He becomes that much more memorable.
He becomes Mr. Irresistible.
Exactly. And that wasn't there really. He, a lot of his stories, like a lot of wrestlers, they tell the stories so many times that they believe them.
Yep.
And they don't really add up sometimes. The claim to have fought, you know, Nature Boy Buddy Rogers for the NWA World title with the Ku Klux Klan at ringside.
In North Carolina, I believe.
In North Carolina, it's like we could never find a record of it. And we looked and we looked, and we've all done it, between myself or Al Getz or, you know, other historians. It just doesn't exist. So it's just like, you know, Roddy Piper's story about his first match was against Larry Henning in 17 seconds. It's like, but he'd been wrestling 2 years before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they make their own stories up, which is pro wrestling to a T, right? If you don't put yourself over, if you don't believe in yourself, you're never going to succeed. So Siki, in his own way, had created these stories or amalgamated a bunch of different memories. And there's certainly no question that he had run-ins with very racist people that, you know, he overcame it and he persevered through it all. That was a big part of the respect I think he had from certainly myself, but I think even his peers, right? No, I'm sure he must have been in a dressing room telling some of those stories.
Yeah.
Right? You know, seeing lynchings and things like that, that it's very hard for us to understand today. But he persevered and kept going. And a lot of kudos to him, respect to the man himself.
So there's a lot more to talk about in terms of his career that I feel like we haven't really got to, but I do want to keep everything moving. But I want to talk about, you know, obviously he starts in the 60s, moving up to, or starts in the 50s, moves up to Toronto in the 60s. He started, well, you know, you all talk about his weight. He started like at 180, was training, and 3 years later was 230. He's this, you know, big burly guy. Up in Toronto, he has a purple hearse, he has blonde hair, he comes out like two mirrors, in this colorful attire, sequined attire, very gorgeous George-esque to a certain degree, almost like a modern, more hip version, I guess you could say, of a gorgeous George type. There's the music aspect to talk about. He has, I believe it was three country albums and one rock record that he put out. There's so much to get to about Sweet Daddy Siki. Is there any big bits that you want to talk about before we start diving into the sort of criteria for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame?
Certainly, I would just add that his wife, Ann, made most of those really colorful outfits that we associated with them.
From
the 60s on.
That's fun.
Yeah. So she made a ton of them. And even just going to his house and he would, you know, he'd pull out the box and start showing us stuff. And, you know, you get to try on. Like, again, it's fun to leave the house occasionally.
Hold on, Rick, did he say you get to try on? Are you saying?
Exactly. You put on his glasses, or you have the atomizer or the mirror and all these kind of things. Yeah, it's
that picture it's has awesome, to really. Exist somewhere, Greg. I'm so sorry. The picture has to exist.
I'd have to look up some of the – because there was a photographer there for the documentary, and I've seen some of those things, but it's the same. Like, how's it any different than when handsome Johnny Berend, who was another one of the Buddy Rogers guys, when he died, his widow, Annie, found, you know, these title belts up in her attic. And one of them turned out to be the original WWF World Championship. The one that, you know, Buddy Rogers had that first little while till they made the new belt for Bruno. And so, you know, my son and I went down to help broker the deal where she sold it. And of course there's pictures of me and my son with this original title belt. Why wouldn't there be? Right. So
you got to take the pictures.
Exactly. But I mean, that's wrestling's provided me so many great moments. And Siki was a big part of that. And I'm glad to have got to know him, but now we got to make the case why he belongs, besides the fact that Greg Oliver, thought the world of him.
Yes, we have to basically through you convince the rest of, well, I'm not going to say the world, I'll be humble here, our listening audience, to consider, at the very least, Sweet Daddy Siki. He's in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame candidacy, I guess, for the first time ever on the ballot. He's in the historical U.S. and Canada region. We'll talk more about that region later. So the first time, really, we're discussing it on this show, just because not many people get popped up on there, sadly, unless they pass away. But the criteria is a very important aspect to this. There's three criteria. Let me see. Do I have it directly in front of me? Let me move this over here. Basically, that is the criteria for the Hall of Fame is a combination of drawing power, being a great in-ring performer or excelling one's field in pro wrestling, as well as having historical significance in a positive manner. A candidate should either have something to offer in all three categories or be someone so outstanding in one or two of those categories that they deserve inclusion. There's all other stuff regarding longevity should be a prime consideration. Unless someone is so significant as a trendsetter or historical figure in the business or valuable that they need to be included. So there's a lot of other little bits and bobs there, but we'll sort of break it down into the sort of big three main categories. And that's number one first, that I like to look at is being a great in-ring performer. I think a lot of times there's the in-ring conversation in terms of work rate and all that jazz. There's also, I like to look at the microphone skills. I like to look at the all-around performer as well. And I think there's not necessarily no bigger performer, but this guy, Sweet Daddy Siki, seemed to have been so charismatic in the ring and such a performer in there that that's, to me, where he really excelled, was that bringing that charisma to the ring and bringing that charisma to life as the extension into is every day with a purple hearse and the blonde hair. So what did you think of Sweet Daddy Siki as an in-ring performer?
The idea is you're talking the people into the arena, right? To come see you. Mm-hmm. And he could do that. And in the end, does it matter whether he could do 1,000 flippity flops? No, because he didn't do it. That wasn't the style at the time. He didn't have to do it. What he had to do was piss off the audience if he's the heel.
Yep.
Or on the rare occasions where he spent so much time there that the people loved him, then he had to keep them loving him and really, you know, putting the heat on his opponent, right? And coming out probably as the victor in the end. There weren't a lot of those times. He really was a heel most of the time.
Yeah.
But it becomes that homesteading idea, right? Where you've been around so long that, especially out east, he became a little bit of an iconic figure. Out east in the Maritimes in Canada, mm-hmm. He became this figure that they all idolized. So from that perspective, he could always keep it moving, entertain. He seemed to wrestle with a wide variety of people. It's not like he just had to have a certain kind of person he worked with. And that's probably important because you can't just discount that he was one of Buddy Rogers' guys, because that would be a little bit like saying, you know, you're only working with the guys that you trusted, that, you know, sure, it's this really close society. They only wrestled each other, which wasn't the case. It was more about they would travel and Rogers would then have four or five guys on those same cards that mm-hmm. they would travel together. And Siki was one of them for a time. There's Billy Darnell. There's a whole bunch of different guys that we already mentioned, Johnny Berend. So there's those kind of guys that traveled with him. So and longevity. So you don't wrestle from the mid 50s until 1988 unless you're pretty good at your craft. Now part of that includes teaching other people. He was a teacher, and some of his students, you know, the best known are Edge and Christian. Was he in the ring rolling around with them? No, that was Ron Hutchison. But did he offer a lot of advice? Heck yeah. And there's a few other guys along the way that he had a hand in helping. And we need to mention that it was Johnny Powers who first teamed with Sweet Daddy Siki to run a wrestling school. And then Powers dropped out, and that's how Ron Hutchison got involved. And they're all good guys. But yeah, maybe not everybody's going to be cut out to stay in business like that. And so Powers dropped out, and eventually Ron and Siki had their falling out, which Ron has never fully understood, but they never did patch it up. Even at the Edge big festival they did in Toronto. I can't remember what year that was, but you know, when they brought out Edge's mom and all these people from his past,
was that an episode of tribute? Was that an episode of SmackDown? Because I saw there was an episode.
Yeah, it was, and it wasn't just on SmackDown. Like they did a lot of stuff that wasn't aired.
Yeah, I want to say that was. So I want to say 2011. I want to say 2011.
That's about right, because it was his retirement, right? The first retirement.
Yeah.
And here he is still wrestling. Adam's quite the remarkable dude too. But yeah, so longevity counts a lot there too, and that people trusted them to teach them. So I think he hits all those boxes in that sense. And as I said, is he, you know, a chain wrestler that's doing all kinds of high spots? No, that wasn't the style he ever needed to do. He needed to get those people at ringside so pissed off that, you know, when he did finally do that heel move and you know, get caught by the referee or whatever, then the place could explode.
Yeah, I think I was watching one of his matches. There's a handful of footage of him out there on YouTube at the very least, with Sweet Daddy Siki wrestling, you know, various wrestlers. I think there was one I saw with, I believe it was the Stomper, the Stomper was working more heel, but like, you know, that homesteading idea that you're talking about, Sweet Daddy Siki, you know, was getting the cheers. Stomper, I believe, attacked before the bell or whatever it was. And then Sweet Daddy Siki, even in his wrestling style, still basically like working heel, kind of like chokes and doing one thing. But he was loved by the fans. He was sort of the anti-hero sort of thing there, where it's like he's the heel, he's the bad guy, but look, he is Mr. Irresistible. At a certain point, we're going to cheer for this guy. We're going to show our love and admiration for him. That level of love that sort of perseveres throughout his career, that we sort of spoke about earlier.
And Archie Gooley is a good example of that too, where that's happened to him, right? Where, you know, he spent enough time in Calgary that he became an iconic figure there as well. But yeah, and there's a couple of guys that took their act on the road too. I'm sure they've wrestled all throughout the Canadian West and then out into the Maritimes. It was a pairing that worked, and however they had it work. And that's a good example, right? Siki never really changed his style a lot. You know, he had his gimmicks down. He had what he needed to do to succeed. And that's what they did.
It's also like, you know, I think that's something that, It's something that is obviously can't really exist nowadays as much, just because I think that, you know, that back then, you know, you're touring, you can work the same style, you can do the same thing for so much longer. You know, you're obviously going to do stuff on TV and bigger shows or whatnot, but it's something that you can extend the life of, let's say, like a gimmick or a style or whatever, because, you know, you're not on TV every single week or whatever, and or, you know, multiple times a week, and that you can and you're not, and it's a style that's, you know, quote unquote, how do I say this, less flippy do, I guess would be the best way to say that, you know, it's, I don't want to say it's not less athletic, but you know what I mean, like it's less flippy do and less sort of that, where you can, you know ground and pound a little bit more, I guess you could say. So is he like the best like five-star worker in the world? Not necessarily, but he's a guy that knew how to draw heat, knew how even to, you know, still maintain heel work while being cheered, and was able to maintain that gimmick and maintain that working style throughout nearly 30 years of a career, 30, 40 years of a career, and then turn that into a training school where he is now training a potential Hall of Famer in this Hall of Fame, Adam Copeland and Christian Cage as well. So it's something that is there's definitely something there in regards to his in-ring ability, you have to say.
Absolutely. And but again, they didn't happen in the biggest cities.
Yeah.
Right. So it didn't happen in New York as much. He certainly never was trying to be on top in the LA territory or, you know, Chicago. He was there in the early days of the Dumont Network. So you can't say that didn't happen, but it just, again, there's this inherent bias against smaller territories that wrestling fans need to get over, but it's really hard for them to do because it's just human nature, isn't it? Right. Yeah. I mean, I do so much hockey writing, and the fact is that the World Hockey Association doesn't get the respect it deserves because it was the knockoff league. But there was some great hockey being played there, and I think there's an inherent bias against those people who played there, which is too bad. And so in the same sense, you know, if you just were in the Maritimes or if you just wrestling in the Stampede Wrestling, you don't get the same respect that you do if you were in, you know, Chicago or the Florida Territory or the places that we always rave about, Atlanta.
Yeah, that is, you know, that's sort of the meta conversation. I feel like that's sort of taking place regarding the Hall of Fame now, because, you know, at this stage in, you know, in 2025 with the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, pretty much like any of those like Hall of Fame level draws are pretty much all in. You know, there might be a couple like rest of the worlds that are hanging around that we have to get in, but pretty much everyone is in on a Hall of Fame level draw. And that's kind of what you're speaking to of like, this thing of not necessarily showing the smaller territories love. It's because, oh, we all show the love first to the bigger territories because those are the objective, bigger numbers, bigger attendance stuff that we can all agree upon. And now, right now, I feel like what's happening with the Hall of Fame is it's shifting to this focus on the smaller territories. I mean, a guy that is literally leading percentage-wise in the historic U.S. and Canada region is Junkyard Dog, a guy that was massive in the Mid-South Territory and then obviously had runs in WWF and WCW that were, for lack of a better word, not as big for in Mid-South. So
And Stampede Wrestling.
I have a whole conspiracy theory about that. I'm going to pin to the board and we'll talk about that later. But yeah, I think that's, you know, a thing that's happening. I'm recording this episode actually tomorrow. I don't know when this is going to release, but then I'm recording this episode tomorrow about the Masaaki Mochizuki in the Japan region, where, again, a lot of your top draws in Japan are practically all the way in. At this point, we're just sort of looking at not necessarily Hall of Fame draws, but can 60% or more people can all agree this guy was a great worker or this guy has great significance. And that is something that I'm finding that shift is happening in real time, and I'm finding that to be a very fascinating conversation.
Part because it isn't like, again, back to hockey or baseball, where there's these guys whose their 5-year window has come up that were great stars. And so they keep the other guys off the ballot. Dave Meltzer there has a really big, wide ballot, which I really respect, right? And I think that helps a lot. And I'm not forced to try to vote for Japan because I really don't know anything about it.
Sure.
So that's a nice option too, because otherwise it would have been even more skewed because it's only about people you know. And we see all kinds of those inherent biases. You know, like Big Daddy, Shirley Crabtree is one of the biggest stars in the history of wrestling, period. But, you know, he was not a good wrestler by any shape of the imagination. So he's never been really anywhere close to the Observer Hall of Fame, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, I believe he fell off. I believe he fell off last year, if I'm not mistaken.
And the guy was a superstar, you know, somebody everybody in England knew. And, you know, how do you, well, you can quantify that. That's a good example, but it's not stats. It's not how many, I don't know. We're getting off the hinge a little bit. Okay, what was the other one we need to talk about with Siki then? So we talked about sort of in the ring. Drawing power.
Well, let's talk about drawing power. Let's talk about stats.
Well, stats are a scam in wrestling anyway, right? Because sure. it's a work business. So you can be the greatest performer in the history of the business and never won a match. Mm-hmm. And that's because A, you know, nobody asked you to win that match or they told you not to. But B, maybe you didn't want to. Maybe you made more money losing. I just had a story in Inside the Ropes magazine about Silent Brian McNee, and who is a deaf wrestler based out of Hamilton, Ontario. And Tunney, basically Jack Tunney at that time, you know, basically told Brian, I'm not letting you win because you're really good at what you do losing, and you're making more money losing than you would if we put you over. Mm-hmm. And so he was okay with that, because in the end it was a side hustle for him, right? He had a real job. But just try it. Wrestling's such a crazy business because your ego wants you to win and be on top, and only part of it is based on your actual talent. And so much of it is based on who believes in you, all those kind of things. Whereas if you're coming up, you know, through, you know, baseball, your talent is eventually going to get you there. Now, you may have a falling out with a general manager along the way, and he trades you to a stinky team or something, but that gives you your chance to go. And how's that any different than, you know, Siki hits the road and doesn't really find success that's lasting until he ends up, you know, wherever it is, right? You've got to go out there and improve your craft. If you stay in one place, it's really tough. If you wrestle the same people again and again, it's really tough. And we see that on the indie scenes today, right? There's guys that have been in the same place forever that haven't really, I don't know, whatever. They didn't have that spark. They didn't have that need to travel. And I think that holds a lot of guys back.
Well, to talk about drawing power, to bring up stats and bring all these sort of things, obviously I did a bunch of research just for look Greg, we have some listeners that are big old number heads, big old number nerds, as I like to call them, so we got to bring up the stats a little bit. Sweet Daddy Siki is somebody that did wrestle in many different places, main evented, semi-main evented the Maple Leaf Gardens several times, as far as I can tell, not always sellouts, but at the very least, you know, wrestled them. Certainly, I think might have done a sellout or something close against the Sheik, or at least it was maybe at least 10,000, I believe, against the Sheik. I forget where is my notes. I don't see it, but either way, but a guy that, as far as I can tell, if you want to talk numbers, in the 60s, wrestling Madison and Maple Leaf Gardens, I'm seeing attendance anywhere between, you know, 4,000 to 9,000. I saw he was semi-main event of a show in 1964 with attendance of 9,000 against Bulldog Brower, where I don't know if you know this story. I saw the story looking at the newspaper articles. It was a story where the newspaper said that if Siki lost, he promised to dye his hair back to the original color. And the thing that confused me even more so, Greg, about this article was that the newspaper reported that Siki's hair was currently pink. Not blonde, pink. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, it was sort of like the way, I mean, even if you saw it up close, it wasn't always, later it became old man hair, but
sure.
Certainly I think it's just a little bit of the dye or whatever he used at the time. Yeah, no, it's not unusual to think it's sort of pink. But the thing about the Toronto guys, when you're reading those articles, is they were often on the payroll of Frank Tunney.
This was my thought the entire time reading these articles was, exactly what you referenced earlier and just the wrestling business in general is how many of these numbers are accurate. Do we just throw out all numbers or is there a consistency in the inaccuracy, if that makes sense? Or is the writers themselves just somebody, you know, it's on the payroll that's in the back office or whatever under a pseudonym maybe of just, that's not, that, I don't know anything else of me saying, is that something that is just like, you know, they're speaking highly or they have writers that are saying all these sort of things, you know, what is the truth? And that is something obviously in wrestling, especially back then in the 60s and 70s, that's just an insane difficulty to read into.
Yeah. And again, your average fan, and I was one of them at some point, you know, when you're doing those initial researches, you know, back when I had to go through the actual, microfilm machines, you didn't understand those connections, right? And how things work, and that, you know, Tunney would show up with bottles of liquor for all the guys in the Toronto Star sports department every year. Like, he knew how to butter these guys up to make sure they got coverage. And having talked to a few of these guys over the years, you know, it's just part of the game, right? Yeah. They knew that wrestling was a work sport. But they could also have a little more creativity, I guess, in some of the writing. And so you can see that in some of those articles. And some of those guys were legitimate sports writers. Maybe they were just young and they got a chance to go to do those. But Toronto was one of the rare places where there was consistent wrestling writing in the newspaper. Whereas a lot of other places, it'd be like, you know, every couple of years, they do a feature about all the crazy fans that go to wrestling or something like that. It's not the same at all. As they did with that.
Yeah, he obviously has a little bit of time. There was sometimes a very colorful language. It always did feel like in those newspaper articles that it got colorful at times. That I was like, yeah, I feel like this writer is having a lot of fun writing whatever they're writing right now. but yeah, you know, they have solid, you know, 5,000-7,000 in the 60s. The numbers obviously grow in the 70s if you want to look at that. With, you know, with the Sheik on top, I saw one that I believe was a sellout of 16,000. Siki semi-main evented against Danucci, and I was like, oh, 16,000. I wonder what the main event was. I was like, oh, it's the Sheik versus Andre the Giant. All right, that makes sense. that probably makes sense. It probably didn't matter. No offense to Siki, it probably didn't matter who was the semi-main event on that show. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely something there in regards of like a guy that worked the territory all over the place was seemingly a draw. You know, obviously I would say probably the Sheik was probably a bigger draw, certainly in the 70s. You know, cause that's a little bit after kind of not after, but mid period to weaning after for Siki a little bit. So, you know, this
I want to
is
say it as an excuse in a way, though. But I mean, if the Sheik is booking those shows,
yeah,
which he was from the early 70s, what was it, 74, I think he started to a little bit later than that. I mean, he's the one to blame for those low attendance figures that you may cite, you know, and it's not any different than, you know, whoever was booking in Memphis at the time or whatnot. Like, I mean, it's easy to blame those guys.
Sure.
And that's why you can't just rely on numbers, because you don't know anything else, right? It's like, oh, it was an afternoon show instead of an evening show, and you didn't necessarily know that. Or there was a big snowstorm, or, you know, there was the Leafs were on the Stanley Cup playoffs that night on the road, so most people stayed home to watch that. Like, so there's so many extenuating circumstances with all these things that I think it's not even fair just to look at drawing power. Like, sure. it's simplistic to just do the numbers.
What would you then, if you wanted to sort of make a case, if you think there is a case in terms of drawing power of Sweet Daddy Siki, what would you sort of define as that case?
That he got booked for 35 years.
Pretty solid.
Isn't that all that matters in pro wrestling, that you keep working? And none of those were shows he booked. Mm-hmm. Or, sorry, I don't know a lot about his booking. I don't think he ever did any, but he certainly never spent any of his money on it.
Yeah,
he knew that there was no point wasting money on pro wrestling.
I think the only booking that he may have done was his training schools. I saw some articles where they had like, yes, I don't think it was benefit shows, but certainly had like free admission shows for all the trainees. There were some that were
like fairs and stuff like that. Yeah. So Edge and Christian both debuted at like the Orangeville Fair or something. Yeah.
I think there was like some that were like food themed, that you had to like bring food, okay, or something.
Noodle Mania.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought up Noodle Mania.
Well, I was at Noodle Mania. So, oh, perfect. That was, well, they found a sponsor, like it was Lipton Soup or whatever it was. And it ran the same weekend as WrestleMania in Toronto. And it was just a free setup, you know, come down, see the matches, not too far from Sky Dome. And yeah, so I mean, I went down the Noodle Mania. I have some pictures of it. You know, I wish I had a better camera back then, right? But you know, I never really got the idea. I could do the point and click, but I could never use the actual f-stops and all that kind of stuff. And I sure forget, I never learned. So that's the one food theme. So that was Ron Hutchison that did most of that, I believe.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, then let's talk about a little bit of that historical significance, because I do think that is probably one of the stronger aspects of his case. You know, there's you know, sort of longevity, and of course, when it comes to that, there is the training of the school, training of, you know, two at very least, obviously trained a lot of different wrestlers, but obviously two extremely famous wrestlers. One that is, as I said earlier, someone that is on this current Hall of Fame that has been on for like 17 years for various reasons. There's a lot to him, and I think number one with a bullet is just being a popular George-esque black wrestler in the 60s in Toronto, which, you know, obviously was a bigger, more inclusive city, but being that sort of figure very early on in wrestling history in the 60s, I think is, you know, sort of there's pioneer elements, I guess is what I'm saying when it comes to Siki.
Yeah, and we shouldn't discount that aspect of being a black wrestling pioneer. And again, what, going back to how you get booked, I mean, the tradition in the 60s and into the 70s was you'd have one African American on your card.
Yeah.
You didn't want to have two, right? They wouldn't compete. So, I mean, there were times I'd ask Siki about, did you know this guy? And it's like, no. It's like he never met him along the way. It's really kind of odd.
And had other black wrestlers, I think, at a certain point, because he teamed with like Rocky Johnson. I saw he teamed with like Bobo Brazil a couple times.
Are you looking at Toronto results though, right? Again, you know, the territories are different, right? Detroit was a little bit more open to those kind of things, and exactly. Probably Buffalo too. But yeah, down south, I mean, Rocky Johnson told similar stories, right? But Rocky Johnson, Siki was like his hero.
Yeah.
So when Rocky started, you know, he was learning as much as he could from Siki. Siki was a bit of a mentor to him. And when we did our sixth Titans in Toronto dinner, which is the one that we feature in the documentary, Rocky Johnson was there. And so he was able to pay tribute to Siki. The ultimate tribute, though, is if you look at The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, in his early matches, he has cutout boots that were exactly like Sweet Daddy Siki used to wear. Yes. So, I mean, he took those from his dad, who took them from Sweet Daddy Siki. And by cutout, we mean that there was a gap at the back where there was like a higher strap, and you saw part of these amazing calves that he had. And so, obviously, both Rocky and Dwayne had pretty good bodies, too, over the years. We'll give them credit where credit's due.
I was doing one research. There was like one person that talked about the Rock connection with Sweet Daddy Siki, and they theorize, and I think this is a deep, like, not conspiracy theory thought, but a deep, like, maybe pull. Do you remember when The Rock was on SNL, and he did, I think it was one of the more recent times he hosted, and he did the sort of promo shoot sketch? Do you recall this sketch at all?
No, but sounds like something you do, yeah.
It was a very funny sketch, but in the sketch, The Rock's character, and who knows if he had any hand in the costuming, but the person that I read the article about, or the person that wrote it, theorized that The Rock in that sketch had bleach blonde hair, and the person theorized that that was supposed to be a Sweet Daddy Siki reference, and I was like, maybe that extension goes even further into The Rock showing some love to Siki.
When Tiger Ali Singh, so mm-hmm. Tiger Jeet Singh's son, debuted in, was this 1997? Early 1997 or late 1996? It was like late 1996. Sure. Dwayne was starting out at the same time. And so they did a big press conference up in Toronto for Tiger Ali Singh. And in attendance was Bret Hart, George Favala the boxer, and Sweet Daddy Siki. And so, and The Rock was there too. Mm-hmm. So that's Rock. Dwayne's first ever wrestling interview was with me, and just talking about his, you know, connections, right? And so Siki was in the room there. So again, just going back, I have a lot of history with all these guys. So it's kind of fun to be able to keep up with somebody for so many years and learn those kind of things along the way that, hey, I did his first interview, and it's still available on slamwrestling.net, though I'm not actually working there anymore.
Got to get the plug in.
What else am I supposed to say? It's like, you know, there's 29 years worth of stuff that I wrote there. I may have some left under bad circumstances, but the fact is that I know I did a lot of great work there and have so many great memories. And even things like writing about the Charlie Pride, you know, calling Sweet Daddy when Charlie Pride died and writing the story that I did for the site, you know, and about the memories that we shared. I wasn't actually there when they did it because it was down in Windsor, and our producer, Jeremy Schell, was the one that connected them. But it was my idea to do it because Charlie Pride was playing in Kitchener, which is a lot closer, and I probably would have gone there. So anyways, I put myself over a little bit when we should be putting Siki over, right?
No worries. I appreciate it. The other things I just wanted to point out with Siki is that obviously he had the training school, when we talked about that a little bit. Just it also felt like, you know, just looking at some of the footage that I can find and some of the like match results and whatnot that I could find, that I noticed like this thing where near the end of his run in the 80s, he got paired with like a lot of younger wrestlers. And I wonder if that was sort of a, you know, little nudge of like, you know, teach him the ropes a little bit. Like I saw he did a tag match with like a 19-year-old Raymond Rougeau. I forget what year that was. There's
probably about 72.
I think it was 72. Or so
in probably Detroit, yeah.
73, December 16th, 73, against the Love Brothers. That according to the newspaper article, 45-minute draw is what that went to. Third from the top.
So Rougeau's in there to take the bumps,
yeah, right? Pretty, like, probably.
Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
I mean, Siki had learned that from River Billy Watson. Same thing as Whip got older, he would pair with young guys. Including Rocky Johnson to take the bumps, right? So he didn't have to do very much. He could have the big comeback.
Yeah.
And so the Love Brothers would have been, again, it would have been Wes Hutchins, who was Hartford Love. He'd be doing all the bumps, and Rotten Reggie, John Evans, wouldn't do the bumps. Like they were two characters too. And I treasure the time I got to spend with those guys.
And then I also saw this one match online as well, similar vein as like wrestling, tag teaming with a young wrestler. I assume it was in the Detroit region, but it was some tag match at some sort of indie show, perhaps. I don't know who the tag team he was wrestling, but it was footage of him winning a bout with Terry SR, who obviously would go on to become Sabu. And I thought, like, well, that's fun. Obviously, you know, with the connection with the Sheik, that makes sense that he would probably similar vein with Rougeau, I imagine, like that this thing of, you know, putting the experience Siki with some of these younger guys and getting that, the, you know, lesson from that tree. I have to imagine that might have been taking place in some regard.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that must have been a Bearman Dave McKigney show, who were, they were sort of outlaw shows in and around Ontario. Like they were licensed, but I mean, the Tunnies owned so much of Ontario, and Bearman would run a lot of smaller towns that nobody else would. And Siki was pretty loyal to Dave McKigney, who had the Bear. And the Sheik kept working too. There's a great, amazing book called Drawing Heat that Scott Teal reproduced with the permission of the writer, Jim Friedman. It originally came out in 88. It's a lot about the Sheik and those later days on the Bearman tour, and Terry JR. Yeah, Sabu. Rest in peace to him too. It's just, that was one of his places where he learned, and Siki was one of the guys sharing that knowledge.
I'm looking at, I imagine this was the original cover of Drawing Heat, where it's just, I don't know who the wrestler is in the front, but then I believe that is a bear behind him.
Well, there's the red cover is the original, which has a whole bunch of like sort of clippings and stuff. And then the bear, that's Dave McKigney with the bear behind it, which is a Roger Baker photo. And I helped, like I wrote the coda for that, where it talks about everything that happened to the guys afterwards, including the crash that killed the Bear Man and Pat Kelly and Adrian Adonis. And I talked to Siki for that because he was supposed to be on that tour and had a premonition that something bad was going to happen.
Oh boy.
And he didn't go on the road.
Oh boy. Well, I guess, yeah. I guess a good thing then.
Well, so plus, go again, get again, copy of plus, Drawing Heat from Crowbar Press. Yeah,
I guess also again premonition, but also karaoke on the weekends. I guess to speak to that, you know, there's also the aspect of he's dueling careers in wrestling and country music. He obviously didn't put out a rock record as well. You know, I couldn't find necessarily like any data on how those records sold. But, you know, putting out several, you know, maybe that speaks to an audience, but it certainly speaks to the love of music that Siki had. And that was obviously ever present up until, I have to imagine, up until the moment of his death, every week doing karaoke shows.
He got a little bit sick and had some issues with memory and
yeah.
Being able to get around. So, yeah, he wasn't out there doing as many shows as the last couple of years. And COVID really, I mean, it took a lot of everybody, yeah. But certainly the aspect of somebody who was out there in front of the public all the time and then having that taken away, it really destroyed him. I mean, there's no other real way to put it. I never saw him again. I mean, I talked to him, but, you know, once COVID came along, he just became a bit of a recluse. And it's too bad, but that's the reality and nothing we can really do about it. Yeah, he... Yeah, I'm getting a little sad modeling when you start talking like that, but it's true. And his one son Reg's been a good friend and kept me in the loop. Certainly called me, and I was the one that got the news out there when he passed. Yeah, so they had talked about doing a tribute to him, but I don't think they have. Anyway, so is he in the Hall of Fame yet? Have we talked enough about that yet to get him in the Hall of Fame?
Here,
Did we miss any of those components?
I don't. I think we got a good amount. I was going to do a transition a little bit. If you want to, I can play one of his songs that he recorded.
Sure.
I don't know. I didn't do the research to see how much of his country music you might know. Was much of his country music that he performed, was that mostly covers, like, you know, standards that he performed, or did he write music as well?
He wrote a little bit, but mostly they're covers, right? He just loved country music, and he knew his audience. Again, back to the wrestling thing, right? Same thing. If you're playing these small towns, and traveling around, you want to play with what they want to hear, right? You're going to go in there. You might play a couple that you maybe wrote, but generally you're going to want to play stuff that they're going to enjoy and come back for again the next time.
Well, as a transition to sort of go to the closing stretch of this episode, I'll play one of those covers that he performed, a very famous song for sure. This will be I'll play a little bit from Sweet Daddy Seeky's cover of Ring of Fire. So here we go.
There's a burning flame.
Oh, just started from the beginning. So there we go. We'll play it right here. Here we go.
And it makes a fire rain. Bound my wild desires. I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. The taste
going a little bit in the
of the love is sweet.
But yeah, Ring of Fire, Sweet Daddy Seeky. Again, that sort of like slow southern twang in his voice as well. Obviously, you know, that plays a little bit in like that country music genre, but that slow sort of country twang, that sort of baritone-y voice, I'll say. I like the composition of the music as well, having the female vocaling. I like the guitar strums. I think there's some strings in the background as well. I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah, he has another record I really enjoyed. It's fully on YouTube. I'll put a link of it in the show notes. Squares Off Against Country Music, 1972 record that he put out. That it was like, I don't know how many songs, but the songs just kept running. It was like a 30-minute album that just was like 20 songs long or something like that.
They're pretty short songs, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He loved music for sure. Yeah, and it's definitely worth seeking out some of this stuff, especially if you're a country music fan. He really does reimagine stuff a little bit. Yeah, I have one of his albums that I actually got from the late great Jim Melby, right? The two historian awards that are out there, the one at Waterloo, Iowa, and the one with the College Rally Club, are both named after Jim Melby. And he made me he burned me a CD of a whole bunch of music, but mainly it's Sweet Daddy Seeky, all wrestling music. So yes, one more good memory when I put that in. I think not only of Seeky, but I think of my good friend Jim Melby.
So as we close up here, I want to, before we talk about the historical U.S. and Canada ballot itself, I want to just real quickly say, is there any last little bits, little tidbits, or you know, even if it's not necessarily information drops or anything, but just sort of looking at the case as a whole, is there any sort of concluding thoughts that you have regarding Sweet Daddy Seeky in the Hall of Fame?
Well, I mean, I hope he gets in. It may take a little bit of educating, as we're doing here. The fact is that I think a lot of it is that bias that we talk about. It's not racial bias in this case. It's a, you know, oh, he never wrestled the big territories kind of bias. And you get that a lot in pro wrestling. And as fans, we need to get over that just in general. You know, just because somebody never made WWE or TNA or, you know, AEW doesn't mean they didn't have a successful career. Mm-hmm. They just did not maybe get known as well. And then, so another guy that nobody's going to really know probably of your readership here, but like Robbie Ellis just died. And, you know, how many pro wrestlers were featured in Sports Illustrated? He's one of the few, and yet he was a Northeast wrestler, right, that never really traveled very much. So does that make him a bigger star than somebody else? In some ways, yeah, because he got mainstream coverage that somebody else didn't. So let's keep those things in perspective. Siki was a very well-known character wherever he was, whatever his town was. Chances are people knew he was there.
I'm going to share my screen real quickly for you. I imagine you have the ballot in front of you, but just in case, I'm going to throw this up on the screen as well. So Siki, Sweet Daddy Siki, is in the historical performers era, US and Canada, 6 maximum votes in this region. A plethora of names on this list. I'll quickly read them out. Ole Anderson, Afa Sika Anawai, Bob Armstrong, Tully Blanchard, and Arn Anderson, with J.J. Dillon, the British Bulldogs, June Byers, Wild Bull Curry, Junkyard Dog, Cowboy Bob Ellis, Preparo Furpo, Black Gordman and Great Goliath, Archie Mongolian Stomper Goldie, the Hart Foundation, specifically Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart, Sputnik Monroe, Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch, The Iron Sheik, Sweet Daddy Siki, Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood, and Mad Dog and Butcher Vachon, and the Von Erichs, Kevin, Carey, and David. You got 6 maximum votes. I believe earlier you said you've already been looking at it, this ballot. So I'll ask what I ask everybody else, Greg. Who are you sort of thinking regarding the historical U.S. and Canada?
Well, I already submitted mine. So
then perfect. We can talk about the entire ballot if you want. That's up to you. But we can – let's
– No, it's okay. I'll say June Byers gets a lot of the guff that because the women wrestlers never got programs, they never got to stay in one place. All those kind of things add up, and the women are historically get knocks against, same as the little people, the midgets. Like they weren't designed to be stars in a town, so they don't get that sort of love that they should have. So yeah, June Byers, 100%. I believe
Masquerita Sangrada is the first little person midget. I don't know. Sorry, I apologize. I don't know the proper terminology right now. But the first ever to be on the ballot is Masquerita Sangrada in the Mexico region.
Really? So I didn't know that. So to me, it's a crime that Little Beaver and Sky Lolo aren't in. Like they were massive stars. Like they performed for the Queen of England. Like you can't discount those guys just because they were not headliners, right? People turned out to see them. Mm-hmm. So I think June Byers falls in that category, right? She was a well-known woman wrestler. The next name on my list here is Wild Bill Curry. He was a guy you did go to see because he was chaos personified, right? And I think we've sort of discount a lot of his career because he spent so much of it near the end wrestling those little towns, right, in the Northeast. Like he would wrestle anywhere. He was on probably a ton of those shows promoted by Killer Kowalski and the Savoldis. It was like he held on too long and you forget how great he was. But at the top of the game, I don't think there was a more wild, crazy wrestler to go watch. And people still talk about him to this day when they're not talking about some of the other names on the list in the same way. Cowboy Bob Ellis is a guy I got to know a little bit through Siki, in the sense that I got to do interviews with Cowboy Bob Ellis that nobody else did. A lot of it's in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame Heroes and Icons. Mm-hmm. And so I feel really privileged to do that. But having done all the work looking into him, he was the main event just about everywhere in his career. Obviously not at the beginning, but you grow into those roles. And Indianapolis is not as big a territory as, you know, say New York. But you know what? He was a huge star there. And that ties into the whole idea of Jim Barnett running Indianapolis. And later Jim Barnett moves to Australia and he brings in all these guys that he used to have there. So drawing power, like it's partly under the control of the promoter, right?
Yeah.
Using you and where. The next one's Sputnik. And Sputnik, I have a soft spot partly because I actually connected one of his kids he'd never been in touch with him.
Oh, wow.
And they got to meet before he died. So there's a little bit of personal connection there with Sputnik. But Again, we talked about the Robbie Ellis example at Sports Illustrated. Who else is featured in the Rock and Soul Museum in Memphis? It's Sputnik Monroe, because he exceeded what pro wrestling was. He became a cultural figure. He became really important in the history of Memphis and helping to desegregate all those arenas and movie theaters and all those kind of things. To me, on that basis alone, he deserves consideration. But the fact is, he was an amazing character wherever he wrestled. And then last, you might guess the fifth name of five. You'll probably know him as Mr. Irresistible Sweet Daddy.
I'm shocked. Genius. Truly shocked.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. We just talked about him for an hour and 15 minutes. So, yeah, I know you're going to be shocked. I just have a hard time with some of the other names on here because they're so recent and they're so hyper-local, right? If you talk about the Hart Foundation, and like they were just a WWF creation. They never really wrestled anywhere else. Yeah, there was a little bit maybe in Stampede. At least the Bulldogs did Stampede. They did lots in Japan. But the Hart Foundation are just WWF. And it's going to come off as more Bret Hart bias or something. But I don't think that's the case here. And some of the other names are just easy to discount as tag teams. As great as they may have been, they were also one territory. Steamboat and Youngblood, same thing. Mm-hmm. The Von Erichs, same thing. Mm-hmm. Rhodes and Murdoch, amazing stories. I still feel so fortunate that Dusty told me so many Dick Murdoch stories, which is in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, the tag teams. But yeah, same thing. They're just not quite on the same element that they traveled as much. Yeah, is it a bias? No, not really. I try to do educated, you know, choices in these cases, right?
Of course.
Butcher and Mad Dog were headliners in a couple of places, but I don't know. They were there partly by convenience, in that Butcher happened to come in and wanted to see his brother, so they would hang out for a while, and then they'd part again. And Butcher loved to travel. He traveled way more around the world than Mad Dog did, and Mad Dog was a bigger star.
You said you had your full ballot. You don't have to give it out. I'm just going to ask. I'm curious and wondering if you want to give your full ballot. You don't have to go full in detail, but if you want to give your full ballot, I would love to hear it.
I only did three in the modern
okay.
performers. I did Edge, Adam Copeland, not just because I've known him forever. I think he deserves it at this point, but it's also one of those guys who's maybe hung around a little bit too long. Is he done in AEW? I don't know. I don't watch enough these days at all. So I'm not really the right guy to ask. But longevity alone, I voted for Randy Orton. And I know that may pain some of my friends who always thought he was dead boring. I just think he's been consistently on the top of cards and truly deserves it. He's a student of the game. He loves the business. He has so much respect for others in the business that's so different than some of his contemporaries like a Shawn Michaels that you never hear about that with. Randy is the opposite. He loves the business. He loves helping people. The other one I really debated is Trish. Trish Stratus, again, is somebody known a long time because she's from Toronto. It was just such a different business. When you talk about influence, she just set the bar for so many people afterwards. And it's a little bit like we haven't talked a lot about basketball. I've thrown out a lot of sports stuff because I write a lot about sports. But Vince Carter's effect on basketball in Canada is truly quantifiable by the fact that, you know, guys like SGA and all these, you know, are stars today because they saw him in 2000 with the Raptors, right? So there's this carryover that goes through the years. And there's a ton of that with Trish and Lita, right? That the people who are wrestling today, those two were their role models. It was, of course, how they were booked, both good and bad, right? There's a lot of ridiculous sexualization at the time that's truly embarrassing to go back to see that now. But they really set the bar for what women's wrestling could be on a national scale. And, of course, there are tons of women that were better than them in the ring and performing that never got the chance, right? They're stuck in Shimmer. They may have been working down in Florida for the Howard Brody promotion with Craig Cohen that Luna Vachon booked. That's another documentary for another day.
Yes.
Is the Luna Vachon documentary I worked on. But so yeah, there's all those different aspects, and that's my little, you know, plug for Trish.
Did you vote on any other reach? Oh, go ahead.
The non-wrestlers is the only one I really did.
Okay.
Jim Johnston. I don't think there's anybody who's meant more to music in the ring than he did. And wrestling music became so much bigger because of him.
Yeah.
Right. And it gave a chance for other guys, you know, like Jimmy Hart had always done stuff, but the Jimmy Hart stuff was a little bit more comical or whatever. Right. Jim Johnston sat down and tried to really come up with who that character was and make that music fit them and fit their entrance so that people popped when, you know, Stone Cold came out. So I think he deserves it and probably won't get the consideration he deserves. Reggie Parks was a sweetheart. I was at the Cauliflower Alley Club with him when he that year he died. Like, he went home and had COVID and died. He never had a COVID shot. So you feel really bad. He became a friend through the years, to the point that I actually sent a couple of my Slam Wrestling writers to his house to see how he made belts. And his standard of making belts raised it for everybody else. So maybe back to the Trish Stratus idea. Somebody sets the bar and everybody else gets to emulate. And when you then have your Dave Millikins and all those guys that follow in Reggie Parks's footsteps, I think he left a bigger impact than a lot of people realize. And I think there's so many more belt marks today that hopefully they're out there, you know, campaigning for Reggie. And the last one was the guy I already talked about, Jim Melby, historian. But more importantly, he was a guy who shared, right? You didn't always get that a ton. Back in the day, researching was so solo, right? You're in the library by yourself. Today, you know, you could pair with somebody and you could tag team the newspaper archive and get a bunch of results within a day. But back then, you know, you're crawling through newsprint and you're going through all that stuff. But Jim knew so much about everything and he ran so many of the magazines, and there's just sort of that, that learning tree that you get out of NFL coaching. I haven't talked football yet. Here we go. The NFL coaching tree idea, right? That, you know, this guy helps this guy, helps this guy, helps this guy, which to me is Jim Melby. And he would talk about so many of the historians that helped him along the way too. So that's my ballot. I didn't overdo it. I tried to keep it nice and simple. And I'm sure there's people I left out that other people will 100% believe in, but that's the nature of voting, right? That's why we do it. That's why you have these shows.
Exactly. Exactly. Hey, look, I'm sure there'll be people that'll hear this and be like, oh, how dare you not vote for this person? But these are your individual ballots. So So what I'm saying is direct that to Greg. So
liverbooks.ca, head there. You can head send me all the hate you want.
I was just about to say the floor is open for plugs. Obviously, oliverbooks.ca is where you can get a lot of books. The Sweet Daddy Siki documentary, hopefully 4K resolution re-release coming to a theater near you, hopefully, or at the very least online some sort of way, if not physical, sure, but I imagine online for sure. Hopefully that comes out soon, because I think that's an important aspect to his case. I'm sort of, I don't know how this might come off, but I'm sort of surprised that when that documentary came out in 2017, that Dave didn't put him, you know, didn't put Sweet Daddy Siki on the ballot in 2017. I don't know what the ballot looked like in 2017. Like, I don't know if it was like stuffed full of slam dunk people or something, and Dave just didn't want to add. But I was sort of shocked that it was like, you know, you have especially when like you have those sort of moments where pieces of information might come out or something, or stories or re-recollections, or, you know, being a documentary that is devoted to one singular wrestler, that obviously to me warrants rediscussion or introspection or whatever, what have you. I was sort of surprised that wasn't the moment where he gets popped on the ballot for the first time. And that's in the same breath, sort of why I'm upset about that and upset about it now of, you know, look, this, you know, Sweet Daddy Siki, obviously a guy that was around in 2017, and now to the nature of this ballot of popping people on in the historical region only when they pass away. I mentioned this, bringing up that thread from earlier. This is a guy that throughout his career got a lot of love and respect. People wanted to reach out to him and get to and reconnect, kindle that sort of friendship from long ago. And this is somebody that we can now discuss and love on Sweet Daddy Seeky only in 2025 when it comes to this podcast and that discussion for him for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. And it's just sort of a sad sort of break that it has to happen or after his passing. So, Greg, I don't necessarily know where to go from there, but I want to make that clear that I very much appreciate you coming on. I forgot that I had a whole conspiracy theory bit to unpin, but I think I'm going to let that go, and maybe I'll throw that to you afterwards in case you're dying to know. But Greg, thank you very much for coming on to the show. I appreciate all your stories, all your discussions about Sweet Daddy Seeky. I very much appreciate it. I guess any more plugs, any more things, the floor is yours.
No, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. He was a treasure of a human being. I'll keep asking about getting the documentary further available. I've done a lot of wrestling stuff at oliverbooks.ca. The one plug I will say is that we lost a dear friend, one of my writers, Jamie Hemmings, in February, and she was only 43. And when we went to her celebration of life in July, we'd done up a book of all her work, and that's available at oliverbooks.ca. It's a real shame. The money, any profits is going to her son, who is just starting high school. So it's a real tragedy, but that's wrestling becomes a family, and whether it's Sweet Daddy Seeky and hanging out with him, or whether it's getting to know a Jim Melby through the years, it's wrestling's a special breed, and we have to be kind of a little bit sick in the head to be following it so much, but it's all good. Thanks again for having me on.
I'll put that link in there. That, by the way, that is A Writer's Writer, the works of Jamie, Melissa, and Hemmings. I'll put that in the link below. Greg, so thank you so much for coming on, and thank you everybody for listening to this episode. I was going to say this month's episode of The Ballot. There will be another episode, or there already has been another episode regarding Masaaki Mochizuki. And if I can swing it, I hope to try to have one regarding Bill Mercer as well before the ballots are due in November. So until, I guess, next time I speak to you, everyone have a good day, and we'll talk to you later. Ring Post Radio is the only show hosted by Ryan Knightsey and Scotty Edwards that talks about the entire world of professional wrestling. With new episodes coming out every Sunday, there is absolutely no reason to not listen to real, honest wrestling opinions from two crazy maniacs. Have a hot boy summer and listen along to Ring Post Radio every Sunday on the Countout Network. This has been a Countout Podcast.